You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 226 of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all. Thanks for tuning into the podcast.
In Washington, D.C., at 10 p.m. on the night of November 6, 1862, Brigadier General Catherine S. Buckingham was summoned to the office of Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. The 54-year-old Buckingham, an Ohio native, had graduated from West Point in 1829 in the same class and four spots below his good friend Robert E. Lee. Here in November 1862, in the midst of a civil war in which he and Lee had chosen different sides, Buckingham was on special duty at the War Department, assigned to the Secretary of War's office. So far in the war, Buckingham had held only desk jobs, but Stanton was about to send him out into the field on an important mission.
When Buckingham stepped into Stanton's office that night, General-in-Chief Henry Halleck was also there. Stanton and Halleck wanted him to deliver two envelopes to the Army of the Potomac. The envelopes weren't sealed, and Stanton encouraged Buckingham to read their contents. One was addressed to Major General George B. McClellan, and it contained two letters. The first was an order from President Lincoln relieving McClellan from command of the Army of the Potomac. The second was from Halleck, ordering McClellan to travel to his home in New Jersey and from there report by letter to the War Department.
The second envelope contained two orders for Major General Ambrose Burnside, one from Lincoln appointing him to command of the Army of the Potomac, and the other from Halleck with the instructions, quote, "Immediately on assuming command of the Army of the Potomac, you will report the position of your troops and what you propose doing with them."
Prior to this, Burnside had already turned down the offer to command the Army of the Potomac at least once before, but Stanton was sending Buckingham on this special errand in the hopes that he would use all of the influence of his position as assistant to the Secretary of War to encourage, persuade, or manipulate Burnside to accept the appointment this time.
Another reason Stanton was sending Buckingham on this mission was that the Secretary of War not only had zero confidence in McClellan's command ability, but Stanton was also concerned because it was no secret that Little Mac and Lincoln, to put it mildly, had not always seen eye to eye on military matters or policy issues. In light of that troubled past, and considering Little Mac's well-known scorn and contempt for his civilian bosses in Washington, Stanton now was afraid McClellan might not obey the president's order to give up command of the Army of the Potomac, and Stanton wished, therefore, that the order should be delivered by an officer of high rank, direct from the War Department, so it would carry the full weight of the president's authority.
Stanton's orders were for Buckingham to find Burnside first and get his decision. If he agreed to accept command of the army, whatever persuasion that might take, Buckingham was then to meet with McClellan. However, if Burnside would not accept, despite Buckingham's efforts, then Buckingham was to return to Washington at once without seeing Little Mac.
The foul weather on November 7th, the day after his late-night meeting with Stanton and Halleck, complicated Buckingham's assignment. Northern Virginia was being battered by one of the worst snowstorms for that time of year on record. But Buckingham commandeered a locomotive and tender in Alexandria and huddled in the cab with the engineer and fireman as the engine slowly chugged the 50 or so miles through driving snow and bitter cold from Washington to Salem, which is modern-day Marshall, Virginia.
After reaching that place, Buckingham borrowed a horse and rustled up an escort and then set out through the newly fallen snow on the 13-mile ride south to the small village of Orleans, where the headquarters of Burnside's 9th Corps was located. Darkness had fallen, and Burnside was eating supper when his unexpected guest arrived.
Buckingham handed Ambrose Burnside General Orders No. 182, which were dated November 5th, and which read, "By direction of the President of the United States, it is ordered that Major General McClellan be relieved of command of the Army of the Potomac, and that Major General Burnside take command of the Army."
It's been a while since we were back east, so to speak, on the podcast. It was back in episode number 200 that we finished up with the Battle of Antietam, but we really need to return to the aftermath of that battle to see what led to Buckingham's mission to deliver the president's orders, sacking Little Mac, and giving command of the Army of the Potomac to Ambrose Burnside.
Yeah, as you guys will recall, after the fighting ended at Antietam on September 17, 1862, Robert E. Lee decided to remain at Sharpsburg the next day, ready to do battle if necessary. In fact, he looked for some way to launch a counteroffensive of his own, but it was not to be. McClellan wired Halleck that little occurred throughout September 18th but skirmishing, quote, "We being fully occupied in replenishing ammunition, taking care of the wounded, etc."
As night fell on the 18th, Lee decided there was nothing more to be gained in Maryland and started his army back across the Potomac into northern Virginia. When he realized the Confederates had retreated, McClellan was thrilled. He wired Halleck saying, quote, "Our victory was complete. The enemy is driven back into Virginia. Maryland and Pennsylvania are now safe."
Little Mac was even more exuberant in what he told his wife, Nellie. Quote, "The spectacle yesterday was the grandest I could conceive of. Nothing could be more sublime. Those in whose judgment I rely tell me that I fought the battle splendidly and that it was a masterpiece of art."
On September 19th, after Lee had fallen back across the Potomac, McClellan wired Nellie and told her, as he had also informed Halleck, that, quote, "our victory was complete."
He also admitted to her, quote, "I feel some little pride in having, with a beaten and demoralized army, defeated Lee so utterly and saved the North so completely. My military reputation is cleared. I have shown that I can fight battles and win them."
The beaten and demoralized army McClellan was referring to was the Union army that John Pope had led at Second Manassas, where Robert E. Lee had given the Federals a good kicking.
Yep. Remember, Lincoln and Stanton had tried to shuffle Little Mac aside and replace him with Pope after the Army of the Potomac was withdrawn from the peninsula after the 7 days' battles. But after Pope's defeat at Second Manassas, Lincoln was forced to put McClellan back in charge of the army. Lee's subsequent strike north and McClellan's maneuvering to confront him resulted in the Battle of Antietam.
In the immediate aftermath of Antietam, McClellan still believed Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia were dangerous. But the fact the Confederates had retreated back across the Potomac and off northern soil was enough for him to think he had indeed worked a masterpiece of military art.
However, the situation wasn't so clear-cut. The outcome at Antietam was a mixed bag, and there were naysayers, even on McClellan's staff. One of these, David Strother, believed, quote, "We had not done enough and lost an opportunity which may never again be presented to us. The empty name of victory is not sufficient. We needed a result crushing and conclusive and have failed to obtain it.
Robert E. Lee pulled off an undeniable defensive masterpiece at Antietam. It had been a brilliant performance against all odds. It was difficult not to conclude that McClellan had blown his chance. He had missed a golden opportunity to destroy the Confederate army. Even with Lee boxed in with his back to the Potomac and only one avenue of escape, McClellan had failed to fix on and execute a definite plan of attack. The Federal army fought piecemeal. There were no coordinated assault along the entire front, which would almost certainly have overwhelmed the undermanned rebel line.
Having dropped the ball by not crushing Lee at Sharpsburg when he had the chance, would McClellan now vigorously pursue the Confederates? Well, pursuit of an enemy army during the Civil War was no easy thing. However, here it was what Abraham Lincoln was expecting. When McClellan informed the president of his complete victory, Lincoln irritated Little Mac by wiring back, "God bless you and all with you. Destroy the rebel army, if possible." McClellan was irritated because while he was busy congratulating himself on his performance at Antietam, Lincoln obviously wanted more. Since Little Mac had failed to crush Lee at Sharpsburg, the president now wanted a speedy and vigorous pursuit.
McClellan, though, didn't believe that under the circumstances that was possible, nor was it something he had his heart in. For McClellan, it was enough that he had driven Lee back into Virginia, saved the North, and put himself into a position to, at some future time, mount a campaign for which he had carefully prepared.
Only when McClellan had once again reorganized his army, resupplied it, reinforced it, and set things in order to his satisfaction, only then would he undertake a new and truly brilliant campaign against the rebels. Truth be told, what Little Mac wanted in his heart of hearts after Antietam was not to set off half-cocked in pursuit of the still dangerous Confederates, but instead to take the winter to get things sorted out and wait until next year, 1863, to go after Lee again. All of that would take time, of course, but after Antietam, and based on his past experience with Little Mac, the one thing Abraham Lincoln was in no mood to give George McClellan was time.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
In John Waugh's book, Lincoln and McClellan, The Troubled Partnership Between a President and His General, he writes, quote, "Abraham Lincoln was thinking two things after Antietam, neither tailored to George McClellan's liking. Here, Lincoln instantly saw was victory enough on which to hang his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, which he had shelved in the summer to wait a turn of fortune on a battlefield. This was not an emphatic opportunity, but it was opportunity enough. On September 22nd, 5 days after that most bloody day of the war, he issued it."
As Lincoln made clear in the proclamation's opening lines, he was doing this purely as a war-winning measure, but nevertheless, Little Mac was outraged. Ironically for McClellan, what he considered to be his greatest moment led to an expansion of Union war aims in the form of a policy he had vigorously opposed. He was unhappy enough that a week after his complete victory, the men he considered his two chief antagonists in Washington, Stanton and Halleck, still held their jobs. He had assumed that Antietam would not only secure his reputation as a winning battlefield general, but he also expected, and made it known that he expected, that it would also lead to his two arch enemies losing their jobs. But now it didn't look as if that was going to happen. He wrote to Nelly, venting about Lincoln's proclamation and about Stanton and Halleck, saying such circumstances, quote, render it almost impossible for me to retain my commission and self-respect at the same time, end quote. For a short while, McClellan considered openly opposing Lincoln's decision to free the slaves, but that would be an open rebellion against authority. He didn't go that far, but neither did he resign.
At any rate, the second thing on Lincoln's mind, equally unwelcome to McClellan, continued to be the immediate pursuit of the Confederate Army. The messages coming to Little Mac from Washington were not filled with the extravagant praise he thought was his due for chasing Lee out of Maryland, but rather they communicated the urgent expectation that he would now do more, namely, strike the battered rebel army a mortal blow.
But what McClellan wanted after the Battle of Antietam, besides more credit for his great victory, was to be left alone. From the first, after being brought back to clean up John Pope's mess, Little Mac hadn't contemplated doing anything more than repelling the invader and saving Washington. So in his mind, he had done what he set out to do.
And in reality, after Antietam, the Army of the Potomac desperately needed refitting and restocking in material and personnel. The Army's veteran regiments were depleted. It lacked essential supplies such as clothing and shoes. With the Army badly needing reinforcement and resupply, McClellan told Halleck that, quote, my present position is to hold the Army about as it now is.
But Abraham Lincoln wanted much more than that. And he wanted it as soon as possible. More than an opening to issue the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln wanted Lee's army pursued and destroyed. So, as he'd done after the 7 days' battles on the peninsula, the president again went to the scene of the action to see for himself what was going on and to prod his reluctant general into action.
On October 2nd, Lincoln reached McClellan's headquarters on the Antietam battlefield. For 3 days, the president was with the army. The story was later told of how, on October 3rd, Lincoln stood on a hill with an old Illinois friend, Ozias Hatch, who had accompanied him on the trip. As they gazed down on the white tents of the vast encampment, Lincoln asked Hatch, "Do you know what this is?"
The question surprised Hatch. But he replied, it is the Army of the Potomac.
Lincoln said sadly, so it is called, but that is a mistake. It is only McClellan's bodyguard.
When Lincoln left Sharpsburg to return to Washington on October 4th, he and McClellan had markedly different views of what had been decided. McClellan believed he had the president's approval and support, while Lincoln left thinking that Little Mac would move forward immediately against the rebels.
But when 2 days passed and McClellan began to argue why he ought not to move, an exasperated Lincoln issued a direct order through Halleck. It instructed McClellan to cross the Potomac at once and give battle to the enemy or drive him south.
Despite the direct order, though, Little Mac did not cross the Potomac straight away. In fact, it would be 19 more days before he started to do so, and those 19 days would be filled with prodding from Washington and delay from him. McClellan would not be left alone to rest and refit the army as he wished, and Lincoln would have no immediate advance against the rebels as he wished.
There was no denying that the Army needed all that McClellan said it needed. Everybody in the Army of the Potomac was feeling the pinch. On October 20th, Division Commander Brigadier General George Meade wrote to his wife, telling her, quote, "I have hundreds of men in my command without shoes, going barefooted, and I can't get a shoe for man or beast."
And Brigadier General Alpheus Williams noted, quote, "There seems to be an unaccountable delay in forwarding supplies. We want shoes and blankets and overcoats, everything." End quote. Although the War Department was addressing the shortages, many of the supplies simply were not getting to the troops in a timely manner. McClellan thought it was truly absurd and unreasonable that Washington was pressuring him to advance, despite the genuine logistics concerns, and so did many of his soldiers. Many of them suspected, as he did, that Stanton and the radical Republicans in Congress were deliberately undercutting Little Mac. Colonel Charles Wainwright wrote in his diary in mid-October, quote, "The old cry as to McClellan's slowness is again being raised. I was much surprised at first myself that we did not cross the river at once, but the more I know of the condition of the army and other matters, the less certain does it appear that we could have done so to advantage. This corps as yet has received next to no supplies. The men are very badly off for shoes and blankets. It seems almost as if they purposefully kept them back in Washington."
Quartermaster General Montgomery Meigs claimed that he was doing all he could to ship the needed supplies to the Army, but McClellan countered that although that may be so, they weren't reaching the troops in the field. Whatever was happening, McClellan was not getting what he thought his Army needed, and he wasn't going to move until it did. In the midst of these logistical worries, Abraham Lincoln wrote McClellan a long letter dated October 13th, in which he tried once again to reason with the general. Lincoln wrote, "You remember my speaking to you of what I called your overcautiousness. Are you not overcautious when you assume that you cannot do what the enemy is constantly doing? Should you not claim to be at least his equal in prowess and act upon the claim?"
Lincoln continued, pointing out that McClellan was actually closer to Richmond than Lee, and if McClellan moved quickly so as to interpose himself between Lee and Richmond, then Little Mac could force the enemy commander to fight a battle on ground and on terms favorable to McClellan. Lincoln said, "It is all easy if our troops march as well as the enemy, and it is unmanly to say they cannot do it."
Lincoln closed the letter, however, by seeming to give Little Mac an out, by writing that his observations were, quote, "in no sense an order."
Nevertheless, this unsolicited advice from a politician, from an amateur military strategist, frustrated and also depressed McClellan. He saw Lincoln's letter as an indication that he would be relieved from command. On October 16th, after meeting at Harper's Ferry with Corps Commander Darius Couch and discussing strategy, McClellan told Couch, "But I may not have command of the army much longer. Lincoln is down on me."
Little Mac was not alone in thinking along these lines. Meade wrote home, quote, "Everyone who returns to camp says that McClellan's position is most precarious, and that if he does not advance soon and do something brilliant, he will be superseded. At the same time, they do not or will not send from Washington the supplies absolutely necessary for us to have before we can move."
But Lincoln was continuing to apply pressure for McClellan to do something. On October 21st, Halleck sent a message saying, quote, "The president does not expect impossibilities, but is very anxious that all this good weather should not be wasted in inactivity. Telegraph when you will move and on what lines you propose to march."
Unfortunately for McClellan, Confederate Cavalry Commander Jeb Stuart chose October to make another daring and attention-grabbing ride around the Federal Army. As y'all recall, back in June, down outside Richmond during the Peninsula Campaign, Stuart had successfully ridden all the way around the Army of the Potomac and gained valuable information about the Yankee dispositions for Robert E. Lee. Now, here in October, Stuart once again rode entirely around McClellan's army, beginning on the 10th when he crossed the Potomac into Maryland, and returning on the 12th when he recrossed the river into Virginia.
Stuart's second ride around the Army of the Potomac could not have come at a worse time for McClellan. It was embarrassing and rattled everyone from the Antietam to Washington. Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles, in his diary, called it, quote, additional evidence of McClellan's alleged inertness and military imbecility. Ouch.
The episode further eroded Lincoln's confidence in McClellan. The president's secretary, John Nicolay, wrote to his fiancée, telling her that Stuart's second ride around the army was, quote, a little thing, accomplishing not much actual harm, and yet infinitely vexatious and mischievous. The president well nigh lost his temper over it.
McClellan had a problem with horses that wasn't related directly to Stuart's ride around the army. You see, the Federals were in short supply of cavalry mounts, a problem that was compounded the last week of October by an outbreak of hoof-and-mouth disease that put nearly 4,000 horses permanently out of service. And many of the rest were in such poor condition they would be of little or no use in active operations.
Without more cavalry horses in good condition, McClellan, on October 21st, warned Washington that his mounted arm would not be able to successfully carry out its responsibilities during active campaigning. He passed along a report from one of his cavalry commanders describing most of his horses as sore-tongued, sore-backed, and, quote, broken down from fatigue and want of flesh.
Coming on the heels of Stuart's ride around the army, this was too much for Lincoln. He shot back a wire saying, quote, I have just read your dispatch about sore-tongued and fatigued horses. Will you pardon me for asking what the horses of your army have done since the Battle of Antietam that fatigue anything? Ouch.
McClellan answered with a rundown of what his horses had been doing. Constantly employed in reconnaissance, scouting, and picketing, six regiments marching 200 miles in pursuit of Jeb Stuart's cavalry, including 55 miles in one day, and constantly patrolling 150 miles of riverfront since the Battle of Antietam. On top of that, many of those same horses had been worn down by previous service on the peninsula. Little Mac told the president, quote, if any instance can be found where overworked cavalry has performed more labor than mine since the Battle of Antietam, I am not conscious of it.
To his wife, Nellie, McClellan vented his true reaction. He told her he was, quote, mad as a March hare over Lincoln's jab, saying it was, quote, one of those dirty little flings that I can't get used to when they are not merited, end quote. In another outburst, he told her, quote, if you could know the mean and dirty character of the dispatches I receive, you would boil over with anger. But the good of the country requires me to submit to all this from men whom I know to be greatly my inferiors, socially, intellectually, and morally. There never was a truer epithet applied to a certain individual than that of the gorilla.
Angry, but pushed to act by the pressure from Washington, McClellan at last began crossing the Potomac on October 26th with his 100,000 troops to confront the rebels. As the Federal Army started out, Alan Pinkerton sent Little Mac yet another inaccurate estimate of Confederate strength, pegging it at 130,000. In reality, Lee only had about 70,000 men.
4 days later, on October 30th, McClellan told Lincoln the crossing of the Potomac continued. But in truth, an unhappier general had never crossed a river. McClellan again reminded the president that he thought this movement was a mistake, and he took the opportunity to state that he blamed Halleck for the fact the army still hadn't received everything he thought it needed to begin a new campaign. In a note to Nelly the next day, McClellan's bitter words show that he thought his true enemies were located in Washington, not over in Virginia. He told her, quote, "If I am successful in this campaign, I think it will end in driving Stanton out. It will afford me great pleasure if I can, in any honorable and open way, be instrumental in consigning the rascal to the infamous fate he deserves. If I can crush him, I will, relentlessly and without remorse." End quote. Again, it's worth pointing out that such language is remarkable, since McClellan there was speaking about Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, not about Robert E. Lee.
Although Abraham Lincoln was pleased that McClellan was at last crossing the Potomac, the president soon came to believe that the general was taking too long to move the entire army across the river. To Lincoln, Little Mac was still delaying, quote, "on little pretext of wanting this and that."
Lincoln decided on a final litmus test, since he was beginning to fear that McClellan, quote, "was playing false, that he did not want to hurt the enemy," end quote. The president later told another of his secretaries, John Hay, that, quote, "I saw how he could intercept the enemy on the way to Richmond. I determined to make that the test. If he let him get away, I would remove him."
Lincoln had stood by McClellan far longer than any of his advisors had wished. The president believed McClellan had many admirable qualities as a man and as a commander, but since the Battle of Antietam, the general had again, to Lincoln's mind, been, quote, "too slow in his movements. He did not follow up his advantages after Antietam. The army of the enemy should have been annihilated, but it was permitted to recross the Potomac without the loss of a man, and McClellan would not follow," end quote.
Now, 6 days after finally starting to cross the Potomac, Little Mac still only had 3/4 of his army across the river. Lincoln's patience was finally at an end. The president was raising the axe and was ready to let it fall.
McClellan, once he finally got the entire Army of the Potomac across its namesake river, was marching southward along the path Lincoln had recommended in his October 13th letter, when the president pointed out that Little Mac could position himself between Lee and Richmond if the general moved quickly.
But McClellan wasn't moving quickly. In 11 days, he had covered only 35 miles. By November 5th, McClellan had reached Rectortown, Virginia. He wrote Nelly that night, saying, quote, "After a considerable amount of marching and skirmishing, we have worked our way thus far into rebeldom. We have had delightful weather for marching and a beautiful country to travel through." The next day, he told her, quote, "The army still advances, but the machine is so huge and complicated that it is slow in its motions."
McClellan was moving too slowly to stop the axe hanging over his head. On November 4th, Robert E. Lee, divining the federal intentions, had managed to put his army between the Yankees and Richmond, as Lincoln feared he would. Lee's ability to easily counter McClellan's movements was the last straw for Abraham Lincoln. Even as Little Mac was riding to Nellie from Rectortown, the axe was falling. On November 5th, when the president learned that the Confederates were at Culpeper Courthouse between McClellan and Richmond, Lincoln, true to his vow, wrote the order removing George McClellan from command of the Army of the Potomac.
McClellan's few allies in Washington had seen it coming. One of them, Francis Preston Blair, had been moving in high circles in Washington since Andrew Jackson's time. One of his sons, Montgomery, was Lincoln's postmaster general. Knowing McClellan was skating on thin ice, the elder Blair went to see the president to see what he could do to save the general and keep him in command. Lincoln listened respectfully to the old man, as he always did, but when Blair had made his pitch, the president stood and declared, "I said I would remove him if he let Lee's army get away from him, and I must do so. He has got the slows, Mr. Blair." Then, in one of our favorite Lincoln lines ever, the president told Blair that he had tried long enough, quote, "to bore with an auger too dull to take hold."
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. And our recommendation this time is Lincoln's Lieutenants, The High Command of the Army of the Potomac by Stephen Sears.
This, of course, isn't the first time we've recommended one of Sears' books on the podcast, and there's a safe bet it won't be the last. In Lincoln's Lieutenants, he traces the saga of the High Command of the Army of the Potomac. He chronicles the highs and the lows, covering McDowell, McClellan, Pope, Burnside, Hooker, and finally, Meade and Grant. Yeah, it's quite a story, and Sears tells it well.
So that's Lincoln's Lieutenants, The High Command of the Army of the Potomac by Stephen Sears. You can find a handy list of all of our book recommendations if you head over to the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
Also at the website, you can find handy links to the podcast's Twitter feed and Facebook page, as well as our contact information and some photos if you're wondering what we look like.
Also at the website, there's information on becoming a member, which not only gives you the opportunity to support the podcast,
but you'll also have access to over 60 extra episodes that we've done just for the members of the Strawfoot Brigade. And we'd like to give a big thank you to Dennis, Carol, Kevin, and Vic, who joined up this past week.
Thanks, y'all.
All right. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. Next week, we'll look at Ambrose Burnside's reluctant ascension to command of the Army of the Potomac. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.